Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron has just finished visits to all five Central Asian states. It had been 27 years since a British Foreign Secretary had visited Uzbekistan, and no British Foreign Secretary had ever visited Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, or Turkmenistan until Cameron's recent trip. In this session of the Mejlis Podcast, we'll look at Cameron's trip through Central Asia, what he had to offer, and how he was received in the various Central Asian countries. And to discuss all this, I am joined by Aijan Sharshenova, research fellow at the Bishkek-based think tank Crossroads Central Asia, Ben Godwin, the head of analysis at PRISM Political Risk Management, who lived and worked in Kazakhstan for 7 years and continues to monitor events there, and Luke Ancheski, professor of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University and author of several books on Central Asia. Thank you all for joining me. First, let's talk broadly about what Cameron's visit means for Britain and what it means for Central Asia. And Ben, I'd like to start with you. What do you see as significant in Cameron's visit to Central Asia?
I guess there are sort of two perspectives from which we can look at it. One is the UK's internal politics. And frankly, we have a Conservative government that is almost certain to lose an election at the end of the year, maybe even sooner. And so while David Cameron has been extremely active on the global stage, and is perhaps the highest performing of all of the cabinet members within the Tory government, the influence that Cameron and his foreign policy is going to have within the UK, it is going to be very limited, because we're going to have quite a different foreign secretary, David Lammy, by the end of the year. But one thing that Cameron has been good at is really trying to focus the UK's attention back on being a global player on the world stage. And that is perhaps something that the Labour government will continue, particularly in its relationships with Europe. And of course, we know that Europe is very interested in engagement with Central Asia. From the perspective of Central Asia, certainly when we speak to officials over there, the view is that there is a whole wave of global shifts taking place, and there is a real danger that Central Asian nations will not be able to balance their relations between different geopolitical players if the West and countries like the UK, obviously the European Union and the United States, are not involved in the next stage of the region's development. Frankly, from our perspective, we see a huge growth of Russian and Chinese investment across the region, particularly since 2022 in the case of Russia, and the level of Western investment is just not following that. So there is a real danger that to Central Asian, sort of this multi-vector, multi-balanced sort of foreign policy is somewhat coming apart here.
Okay, thank you. Luca, you know, Cameron had several points that he made in every country. You're a professor at Glasgow University. One of Cameron's big selling points was a educational exchange. But there was others too. Of course, you know, he talked about, respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity, and he was there to strengthen it. But I'm curious, how's your view of Cameron's trip through the region?
Bruce, the foreign secretary trip to Central Asia actually follows a series of actions that within the parliament at the cabinet level have been taken in relation to the UK's engagement with the region. So there has been an inquiry going on. Some of us have been involved in offering evidence to inquiry. Then, of course, there's been a report published. And there has been also, of course, a government response. So a pretty standard procedure in the Westminster system. But just to make our listeners understand that this is not a one-off. It came from some kind of policy rethinking, you know, inter-institutional conversation going on. So my assessment in general terms is positive, because I think that some of the issues that were discussed in Parliament, education is one of them, of course, have been addressed by the Secretary in going in the region. But also, like, we really need to assess the visit for what it is. I mean, Ben is right, it's about global Britain, but the amount of business, amount of treaties that have been sort of signed, it's marginal if we compare that to China and Russia. I think that there are some comparison out there at the moment. So it's certainly a departure from the prior practice, which was just ignoring the region. But also we need to sort of contextualize this in the fact that, you know, as Cameron said, we are not there to replace the other partners. We're here to offer you an option, but the option they offer is quite minimal. Although development, you know, to my mind, particularly those the doubling the Chevening scholarship total is something which, you know, we welcome, we advocate with, and it's good to see inside. But there are different dimensions, of course. And to me, the domestic policy of the UK is also very important. We can discuss this later.
Okay, thank you. John, you're in Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan. How was Cameron's visit portrayed in Kyrgyzstan? I mean, what were people talking a lot about it, or it didn't get much attention, or a lot of attention? How did it work?
Hello, Bruce. I am indeed. It was a bit unexpected, I believe, because even for myself, because I got to know, I got contacted by some journalists and I discovered that Cameron was in the city and I was not ready at all. So I think if we had a bit of a head notice, there would be probably a bit more conversation about it. But it felt a bit fleeting and fast because he's arrived, he spent maybe a day and a half, and then he headed to either Tajikistan or Uzbekistan, I'm not sure now. But it certainly was very much welcome. It felt that Kyrgyzstan is getting some international attention, definitely more than before. It felt that Cameron is very keen to leave a good impression because he was meeting with the president, he was meeting with some journalists as well, if I'm not mistaken. He did some courtesy visits to Atabeid, the location to commemorate political prisoners who perished in the 20th century. So it felt that overall it was a very respectful, very thought through, very meaningful visit. And some of the announcements that were made at the end of his very short trip to Kyrgyzstan were very positive. Like Luca mentioned, the doubling of number of Chevening scholarship. I think they also declared 180 million trade investment opportunities for Kyrgyzstan. Also, some plans to support English language learning in the country. He also mentioned something about human rights, but that was literally the last point in the list of things. So I think that was quite indicative. And I agree with my colleagues. It's great that they are coming. It's great that we get a bit more attention. But you cannot help thinking that this is because of the war in Ukraine, which is fair enough, but let's be honest about it.
Oh, thank you. Ajahn mentioned an interesting point. You know, a lot of leaders make these whirlwind tours through Central Asia and they just go to the capitals. But Cameron actually got around a lot. He went to Nuruk, the hydropower plant, the dam in Tajikistan. He was visiting different cities. He went to the memorial in Bishkek. He seemed to be pretty well prepared. You mentioned there's going to be a change in government, but you think it's fair to say that Britain has really put Central Asia back on its map again?
I think the major outcome from this, obviously we had this critical minerals dialogue between the UK and Kazakhstan. And we note, for example, we largely work with investors, but we note that the UK government alongside the European Union government have been engaging extremely actively, particularly with Kazakhstan, but other Central Asian nations on issues such as the energy transition, accessing critical minerals, hydrogen projects. One area, I think, from Cameron's visit and from the current government's policy towards Central Asia that will remain is probably this aspect. And in fact, it may strengthen with a new government in the UK because a new Labour government is likely to move much more in lockstep with the European Union, which is also obviously engaging with Central Asia. So I think Cameron's visits to places such as the hydroelectric plant, a lot of discussion about critical minerals, that is likely to continue. What we haven't seen, and this is certainly a bit of a bugbear from Central Asian governments, is they say that there is actually a lot of quite good high level engagement between Central Asia and Western nations, but the businesses are not necessarily following in lockstep with the government, and that's a question of course of getting the investment climate right. Central Asian nations are also very early in their journey for developing critical minerals, which makes it difficult for large investors to come at this stage. But one thing, as I said, that will remain for the UK and the European Union is this emphasis on critical strategic minerals.
Okay, thank you. Luca, how much of a disadvantage is it for someone like Foreign Secretary Cameron or really any Westerners when they go through the region that they're not coming with a bag of money? You know, I mean, China, every time the Chinese are there, they talk about, you know, deals that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Russia hints that they're really willing to do this. And of course, we know Rosatom is lobbying to get the contracts for nuclear power plant in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. The Arab states have also stepped up lately, too, and been offering signing these huge packages of deals with the Central Asians that are worth multi-billion dollars. I mean, how much of a disadvantage is it for someone like Cameron to come through and try to make an impression without actually having a lot of money to spread around?
Well, this is a different foreign secretary from the one that they had before. Because, I mean, first of all, David Cameron used to be the prime minister, so a very highly recognizable figure. But also, currently is not a member of parliament, I mean, a member of the House of Lords, which means he has got more time to conduct these trips. Which means that the way in which British foreign policy has been conducted since David Cameron, well, got appointed, is somewhat different from the praxis. So in that sense, the some of the disadvantages of not having that much money are actually somewhat compensated by, you know, the star, if you want, figure that the secretary is, but also by the fact that he can sit down and talk for longer with his counterparts because of his specific circumstances. And of course, this whole conversation we're having in this country about what global Britain should be about is conducive to having a situation like this in which even if it's a faraway place, Britain has to go and do some dealings. So, yes, you're right. We cannot compare the magnitude or whatever went on this week with the big deals that have been promoted, of course, by Russia and China, but also by the US. But there is one thing which we need to discuss, and I think is the fact that we have now this interest of different European states or single European states or even Asian countries to interact with Central Asia as a region. So, for instance, I think that later next month, you have the five plus one, where the five Central Asian states meet the leadership of Italy, you know, which is my own country. And you see that there's something, you know, very similar to what happened in Britain. So there is a renewed interest in the region. Now, I am not sure whether, you know, as Ajahn mentioned before, this is only to do with the war. It certainly has to do with the war. But I think that finally this idea that Central Asia is not just a place for geopolitical competition, but is a place where you can have some economic activity is something that has been becoming more thought of in European capitals. So I think that I put this Cameron trip in the group of different initiatives that we see going on in the European, but also like Asian state when it comes to Central Asia.
Let me ask a follow-up, and I'll get back to you, Ben, and I'll come to you in a second, Ajahn. But let me get back to you, Luca, for just a second here. Cameron went through, and he's said the same thing we've seen a lot of Western officials say to Central Asian leaders, which is, we would appreciate it if you wouldn't help out Russia by, you know, redirecting goods that are under sanction out there. How does that play out there? This is a constant message. Anytime there's a Western official out there, don't help Russia violate sanctions. Do you think it's having an effect?
You mean in Central Asia?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I know. I don't think so. But I don't think there is much more that Cameron could say. I mean, obviously, a lot of foreign policy has to do with domestic politics. So whatever reference the foreign secretary made to sanction also appeal to the domestic constituency here in the UK, because it is a country where there has been a consistent, pro-Ukrainian position, which is, you know, somewhat different, for instance, from what you read and hear in Italy, at government level and within the population. So it seemed to me that he says that because part of it is for domestic reasons, but also because the numbers are striking. There is quite a substantive amount of money being used for sanctions and convention in Central Asia. So I am not sure when. I mean, maybe this could be the new version of We Touch About Human Rights, which is something that you had to say when you go to the region, but no one really does take you seriously for. So it could be just lip service, but it is a very important problem that is.
Thanks. Lip service was a term I was thinking of too. Ben, how do you see that? I mean, is it just lip service, or do you think there's any bite to that?
It's extremely difficult. I was in Kazakhstan last week, and certainly people on the ground will say we're in an impossible position. You know, Russia is a key trade partner for Central Asian nations. You've cut off your trade and investment activities with Russia, which means that Russian trade and Russian investment has been diverted from Europe and other markets straight into Central Asia. And so by cutting Russia off from Europe, you're essentially pushing us closer towards Russia or integrating us more tightly with Russia. It seems to me that Western governments are cognizant of that and understand that. And there seems to be a sort of tacit understanding that as long as the sanctions violations, for example, and there have been examples in most Central Asian countries now of entities violating sanctions, as long as that's not perceived as a state policy and not perceived as wholly egregious, then I think Western governments are pretty sensible about having a balance. If it's one or two entities here or there that have been set up by Russians within Central Asian countries, that's one thing. But it certainly changes if a particular Central Asian country decides that actually it's going to be their policy to assist the Russians in violating sanctions in a very egregious way. And frankly, I don't see any evidence that any of the countries have that sort of outlook. So Cameron has to say it. They will play a little bit of whack-a-mole as these entities pop up. But we don't anticipate that Central Asia is going to become, you know, heavily regulated by the sort of sanctions action from the US or Europe.
Okay, thank you. John, he brought that message to Kyrgyzstan too. Appreciate it if you wouldn't help Russia violate the sanctions. Kyrgyzstan has been singled out a lot by international media for helping Russia out in this. Did the media cover that aspect of Cameron's visit when he was in Kyrgyzstan?
Not in the local newspapers, as far as I know, like not in the local media outlets, as far as I know, but we have been singled out, and there is a general feeling that it has been a bit unfair to Kyrgyzstan, because obviously they're very small. So when it comes to evasion of sanctions or trading with Russia, again, we're not the biggest player in the region. So it feels like we are being targeted for not being able to fight back potentially, or not having any repercussions if we're cut off the world trade. And then I agree with Ben as well, like whenever the US or the UK or the European Union declare packages of sanctions directed to stop the trade with Russia, they're usually listing specific companies, and those companies are private companies, and they're very small as well, most of them. I'm speaking about Central Asian companies at least. So they're not like a long-standing, large functioning company that's been around for a while and all of a sudden has gone rogue. It's usually companies that have been created in the last 2 years, and very often they are created by Russian expats with a front of a local person who's probably taking responsibility for it when everything ends. So it feels that the state itself is not directly involved in the illegal or illicit trade with Russia. It feels that it's private companies, and they are quite difficult to trace even for the government here. It would be interesting to see how they're going to counter that. But it does feel that Kyrgyzstan is being singled out unfairly. And also, if you wish to address the sanctions and the efficiency of sanctions, you sort of need to start where trade starts. So obviously, it's Western companies trading via those countries. So I think there should be a bit more attention paid to the domestic market and domestic players or actors in the West.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks. John, I have a question for you also. Well, I would think one of the more popular things that Cameron spoke about in Kyrgyzstan was the possibility of bringing workers from Kyrgyzstan to come in and work in Great Britain. We already know there are some Kyrgyz citizens who have been working in Britain, several thousands of them. Did that aspect of his visit, did that offer get a lot more media attention? And what did people think about that, especially given the situation with migrant laborers in Russia right now, from Central Asian migrant laborers who are, you know, living in fear of being attacked when they go out on the street? Was Cameron's offer something that the media played up a lot and said, here's another opportunity, as opposed to going to Russia?
Yes, indeed. I think that is actually something that the UK could offer that seems to be like mutually beneficial, that seems to be supporting grassroots level, not the governments, but the people of Central Asia. You're right, especially with the coincidence of the Crocus shopping mall attack and the aftermath of it, the deterioration of the position of Central Asian labor migrants in Russia. I think this offer was very much welcome on the ground because, again, it's not just an opportunity for a labor migrant to go for 6 months and work in the UK and save up some money. It is also an opportunity to improve the language skills or to be exposed to something different, because with all due respect to Russia, it's not too different to Central Asia. We come from the Soviet past. We consume probably the same entertainment products. We speak the same languages very often. So it feels that an opportunity to work in the UK is actually a bit more interesting from many points of view. But generally, there is a trend of diversification of labor migration from Central Asia. The world is getting bigger, more connected. So there are interstate, intergovernmental programs as well between Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and say Turkey or South Korea or even Hungary. So there are more opportunities for people to venture out and probably learn something else apart from just being a not very well qualified migrant in Russia.
Okay, great. Thank you. We've reached the midway point. So a reminder, we're talking about British Foreign Secretary David Cameron's recent visits to Central Asian countries. And my guests are Ben Godwin, the head of analysis at PRISM Political Risk Management, who lived and worked in Kazakhstan for 7 years and continues to monitor events there. In fact, he was just there last week, as he said. Luke Ancheski, the professor of Central Asian Studies at Glasgow University and author of several books on Central Asia. And Aijan Sharsheneva, research fellow at the Bishkek-based think tank Crossroads Central Asia. Let's get a little bit more into the individual countries and what happened when he went there. To these individual countries. And Luca, I'd like to start out with you because we'll get to the one that's probably the shortest visit and the easiest to deal with, Turkmenistan, which he actually recorded a video. Cameron recorded a video that was posted widely on the internet. Did anything significant come out of his visit to Turkmenistan, or was the visit itself
I don't think so that there is any kind of significance in terms of the deal that he did conclude with Serdar, because I don't think he met Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov himself. So, no, I mean, it was a short visit, you know, like highly recognizable with this video that's going around now. I don't have to explain to my students where Turkmenistan is. I can just use David Cameron's video to tell, you know, sandwich between Russia and China and Iran, apparently. So, no, what was interesting is that we didn't really see the government of Turkmenistan using Cameron for photo opportunities in terms of, you know, for image making and image building, reputation building purposes. It was a short visit, really, and one which obviously is constrained by the very idiosyncratic policies of the Turkmen government. On the one hand, there is no possibility for British companies to invest onshore, because that's what the policy says in the gas fields. And also, on the other hand, human rights is quite an intractable partner when it comes to Turkmenistan. So, no, there were limits to what he could do. It seemed to me the country that was less relevant in his visit, because also when it comes to education, it's not easy to establish partnership with Turkmen University, so I'm not sure yet there was much to offer. So it was a bit of a low light, if you want, on the trip, but I am not sure there'll be much follow-up. That's my point. It's just one off, a bit of a low light moment in a visit, which on the other hand has had a lot of relevance and international air.
Okay, thank you. Ben, I know you don't follow Tajikistan too close, but of course this is where he started. And I'd mentioned they went to Newark, and you were talking about critical minerals. Did you see anything significant come out of his visit to Tajikistan?
Other than platitudes, I don't really see anything that's going to lead to any kind of specific action. I would imagine much of the conversation was probably also behind closed doors about Afghanistan rather than Tajikistan while he was in Dushanbe. But I think in terms of an investment destination, we've briefed a number of, for example, mining companies on the various different jurisdictions, and frankly, outside of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, there's very, very little interest.
I'm going to ask you, Ajahn, about this in a second too, but Ben, just at your comments, what about the climate change? This was one of the things that especially Cameron talked about when he was in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. Anything there?
The one leading light of sort of state policy from Western nations that we've seen across the region is the role of the EBRD. And the UK is one of the major countries financing the EBRD. And frankly, as an institution, it's been doing some terrific work on issues such as decarbonization and combating the impacts of climate change. So I don't really envision much direct UK-Tajikistan cooperation, but an increased role for the EBRD, more funding from the UK via the EBRD. And one thing that Britain is probably pretty good at is providing expertise that can assist with that. But I would imagine it would largely come through sort of these sort of development finance institutes like EBRD and ADB.
Okay. Ajahn, I would think this climate change and helping to combat climate change would be a popular topic in Kyrgyzstan. What did people say about that?
It is indeed, and I believe that's actually a really good area where British Kyrgyz cooperation would go ahead, specifically in Kyrgyzstan. And David Cameron gave an interview to Azatik about this as well, not about this only, but also about other things. But one of the first things that he mentioned was the shared interest in addressing climate change in the region and also helping Kyrgyzstan develop green economy. They are quite interested in this at the political level, and I think this is something safe, so to say, to engage on. Obviously, conversations about democracy or human rights are not particularly welcome in Central Asia or in Kyrgyzstan, but conversations about the wonderful green future, green economy, sustainable energy, I think are safe in a way to engage with. But again, what exactly would be done? I think that the follow-up is very much important. So it depends whether there would be some specific concrete follow-up on the things that have been discussed. Also, on the Kyrgyz side, it's quite remarkable that President Japarov went to COP in Glasgow last year or a year before that. So I think that also signified that at least Japarov as a president maybe did not choose green economics or climate change as the top priority internationally, but this is something he wants to be seen as being a champion of and in the world and in the region. So this is something that has a future, both on the British side, on the Kyrgyz side, and generally for the sake of the humanity. I think we do need to address climate change.
Let me follow up, because we were talking about the foreign representatives law before the broadcast. Did Cameron mention anything about the role of NGOs in Kyrgyzstan, or did he avoid that entirely?
He did, but he did it really well. I think, like Ben said, he's one of the more efficient foreign secretaries, a diplomat in the way he speaks. And I think he did mention it in a way to tick the box that we've done that. He did say that we discussed the questions regarding a viable democracy in the country. We discussed volunteers and charity organizations and non-government organizations and civil society, and democracy is very important to us. But he didn't say anything specific, and he didn't say anything, I feel that people, probably especially civil society, wanted to hear a bit more, because obviously the foreign agents law is very much fresh. It has been signed about a week or 2 weeks ago by the president. We are expecting now to have some bylaws published by mid-May, which will show how the law would be implemented, whether we go the Russian way or we go our own way. But either way, it is a huge deterioration of situation in the area of democracy and human rights. And again, yeah, like we cannot say that Cameron did not mention that, but to the extent that he discussed it, I feel that that wasn't particularly enough.
Okay, thanks. Let's move on to Uzbekistan, where Cameron clearly seemed to be pretty happy to be in Uzbekistan and be photographed all the time. I think we've all seen the photograph of him stirring the plov, for instance, but visiting also some of the historical sites. Luca, how do you think that leg of his trip worked out, the trip to Uzbekistan?
Well, there was a big absence there. Mirziyoyev was on leave, was he? So he didn't really have that much of photo op with David Cameron. So, look, this is a different context compared to the others, because Uzbekistan has been particularly active in reaching out to the international community. So, I mean, again, within the confines of what the UK could actually offer to the Uzbek government, Cameron could not come home with that many results. It's interesting that, you know, that he published these two op-eds, one in Kazakhstan on Blast, a very similar one also to Uzbekistan in Gazeta Tatuz. So there were reference to education, there were reference to trade, there were reference also, as I mentioned before, to work arrangements for migrant workers. It's all very little, but as you said, they seem to have had a great time. And also it could be a sort of stepping stone to increase people-to-people ties, not just in terms of bringing Uzbek migrant workers here, but maybe also in trying to have more British tourists going to Uzbekistan, because that's an area in which the government in this country seems to be very, very interested in. So it seemed to me, again, that this is not the fulcrum of the trip itself, but it is an important state, and he recognized that it is a partner that the UK should do more work with. I'm not really sure what kind of civil society human rights conversation went on. I mean, they possibly did go on beyond closed door. But again, you know, I'm sure you're going to go next there, but the big one here was Kazakhstan. So compared to Uzbekistan, there was much less discussed, I would say.
Okay, thanks. And we'll get to Kazakhstan in a minute, but I want to hear what Ben has to say about Uzbekistan too. I mean, one of the things that Cameron discussed, and connectivity will be also part of the last comments that we have, but Cameron was talking about helping build high-speed trains. He talked a lot about connectivity. Did you see any projects there in Uzbekistan that Britain seems particularly well positioned to engage in Uzbekistan?
In terms of building infrastructure, almost certainly not. But one thing that Britain is very, very good at is providing expertise, providing access to capital. And this is something, and obviously education. And it's hard to compare the two when you see, for example, the Chinese building huge infrastructure across the region. Actually, access to capital markets is so critical to these countries. It's another way that they can finance the infrastructure that they need. And it's a way of doing it without becoming dependent on more debt from particularly China. And so while a lot of the agreements are not sort of David Cameron with a shovel, you know, breaking ground to build a high-speed railway or something, I think that's very unrealistic. One way that the UK in particular can offer Central Asia a different geopolitical outlet is by helping Central Asian nations, including Uzbekistan, to develop their own management of their economy in a way that allows them to access capital markets, to access international services. And that will make these countries a little bit less dependent on, say, Russia and China, and allow them to have more of a balance. So issues such as international public offerings, issuing bonds, you know, these sound like kind of dull financial sort of financial transactions, but they are very important. They are a way that these countries can access money and finance for their own development and infrastructure without going to the Russians or the Chinese. This is why they're also pursuing relations with the Gulf, because it's an alternative source of capital.
Okay, thank you. And we'll finish up with Kazakhstan. And Ajahn, I'm going to start with you. You were watching Cameron as he went through the region, and you must have seen what he's up to in Kazakhstan. Is there a difference between his visit to Kazakhstan and the visit to Kyrgyzstan?
In a way, it is. I guess Kazakhstan is bigger. Kazakhstan has probably got a bit more trade with the British companies. So he talked more about business in Kazakhstan. So he talked more about trade. He talked more about small and medium size private companies that might be engaging in Central Asia. He also talked about Astana International Financial Center, so it felt that this is something that people on the ground probably identified for him to focus on. He talked more about education as well, because obviously Kazakhstan has got a bit more money to invest in education. And he did mention that some of the British universities were launching new dual degree programs and opening some branches in the region, which is very much welcome, by the way. That sounds really fascinating. So I felt the difference was there. I think the difference was with the sort of the partner you're talking to in terms of size, in terms of economic capacity, in terms of bilateral relations. He also did mention some of the British companies. And obviously Shell and BAE, they probably run businesses in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan rather than in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. There was also a difference in the way he engaged with journalists, because it was quite interesting, actually, because in Kyrgyzstan, he gave an exclusive interview, a quite big one, to Azatlik. And I think that was a signal as well that Britain supports independent media and media that work in Kyrgyz language, too. And in Kazakhstan, he actually wrote an op-ed, which I did not expect at all, for Vlast.kz. So this was an interesting source, and I'm definitely taking it and using it as a primary source of information now, because that's Cameron himself expressing the future that he sees, the position of the UK in the region. So it is quite a fascinating piece. So if you haven't read it, I do recommend to read it.
Okay, thanks. Luca, what did you see in Kazakhstan during Cameron's visit that really jumped out at you?
I know, for me, the education side, of course, for obvious reasons, is the most important one. Especially because I have been lucky enough to witness firsthand how important it is to have a dual degree awarded with Kazakhstani universities. And it seemed to me that what the foreign secretary did is something that, it could be a bit of a groundbreaking event in terms of bringing more Kazakhstani students to study in the UK, as most importantly, also give some of our students the opportunity to go to Kazakhstan. Of course, I think that to really understand what was going on, we had to go back to the point that Ben was making at the beginning. In fact, this is a government that it's very unlikely to stay in power beyond the end of the year, which means that there are some continuities that you can expect between the two, but there are also some policies which, are a bit of a question mark. So, if the UK is serious about bringing more Kazakhstani students into our system, how does that relate to the very stringent visa regime we currently have when it comes to international students? That's something which, some of us, well, most of us, hopefully think that will change, hopefully, or at least hope that there will be a new attention to this kind of problematic by the incoming government, should there be one. But it's also because the more you have, the more you create the critical mass of Kazakhstani students who experience the West. What we notice, with the current scheme is that those who came here and then returned to Kazakhstan don't really bring that much change because the system is too entrenched. So this is a way to sort of socialize these students into some kind of less authoritarian and more democratic system, which obviously doesn't work because the number is more and the system is too strong. So that could be something which could arise from the David Cameron, the Cameron visit, the teaching language, teaching Kazakh in the UK universities, and although it's Oxford, which is not your standard university, is something which, is extremely important. And, you know, for the people who do the job that I do, this is a very positive, very something to be commended. So maybe a little bit selfish here, Bruce, but I thought that the education, even because it goes back to discussion that, you know, we've had as part of the parliamentary inquiry on the UN Gender Research Relations, is something which, you know, it's crucially important for UK Central Asia cooperation in general and Kazakhstan more in particular.
I agree. Ben, I'd like to get your thoughts on this too. You lived in Kazakhstan. You're from Britain and you're back in Britain right now. What did you see during Cameron's visit to Kazakhstan that really jumped out at you?
It's interesting because I was with Cameron when he went in 2013, and the Cameron government at that time was heavily, heavily focused on getting specific deals off the ground. This seemed like much more about creating, and this sort of goes back to my previous point, creating an ecosystem in which Kazakhstan and the other Central Asian nations are able to access capital and services from and be part of a global supply chain that will be feeding the European Union and the UK. And actually, these things such as cheapening, they're not insignificant. They are important in terms of soft power development. If you look at a number of people, for example, at the top of government within the presidential administration in Kazakhstan, there's a very large number of them now that actually graduated in the UK and certainly have sort of warm memories of the UK as a result of that. So while increasing places at UK universities, setting up dual degrees, and there have been a number of UK universities that have set up campuses now in Kazakhstan as well as schools, these soft power efforts actually do create a lot of goodwill and will longer term help Kazakhstan create that alignment with the UK and with other Western nations.
Okay, great. We get to the last part of the program. So you can put in say anything you want, last comments that you want to make, something you think we've missed. But I will pitch out, what do you think was the big accomplishment from Cameron's recent trip through Central Asia? And I'll start with you, Ajahn.
I think the biggest accomplishment is probably just the fact that he came over and he visited all five Central Asian countries, along with Mongolia as well. If I'm not mistaken, he's currently in Mongolia. I think the accomplishment was also that he listened to his own parliament in a way, because the Foreign Affairs Committee held a hearing on UK engagement in Central Asia last year. And it seemed that the committee itself was quite pleased that the government has taken on board quite a few of the recommendations provided by the committee report. So I feel that it was actually a domestic win in a way as well, because he did listen and his government did deliver something. I think it's good that he came and his visit coincided with a few other visits of Western partners, because maybe that was planned, maybe that wasn't planned, but on the outside, it looked like the UK, along with the EU, along with the US, are sort of collaborating together and seeing Central Asia as an important and increasingly important actor on its own. So I think, overall, I got a positive impression of his visit. I think that he did it well. He did it respectfully, and they obviously did their research beforehand. And I think those visits to stir some plov or to pay respect at the grave of our fathers at Abid, I think those were quite significant soft power wins as well in the long run.
Okay, thank you. Ben, biggest accomplishment or accomplishments of his trip through Central Asia?
I mean, frankly, we've seen, particularly since the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, a real drop in Western engagement in the region. So I agree with Ajahn that the fact that he came and visited every country is important. But I think hopefully it will create momentum for when a new UK government comes into power, for that engagement to remain around some of these critical areas that we've discussed. And as I said, with potentially a Labour government being much more closer to the European Union, there's really now an opportunity for both the UK and the European Union to work together and maybe bring their own individual initiatives together and actually increase the role of Europe as a whole within Central Asia.
Okay, thank you. Luca, you get the last word. What were the biggest accomplishment or accomplishments of this trip?
Oh, I can only agree with both Ben and John. I mean, the visit, the fact that the visit happened, and it happened in line with what has been discussed prior, you know, in the parliamentary inquiry, the government response, it tells you that there is some kind of interest in the UK, in the region. I mean, the problem, as Ben was saying, is whether or not they're going to be able to sustain the interest beyond the change of government, which, you know, is expected if you believe the polls. What I am more interested, particularly because of, you know, the kind of job that I do, it's the impact that this visit could have on people-to-people ties. So that's something which, to my mind, would be the measurement to assess whether what we see here is just an occasional foreign policy trip or could be the determinant of some more sustained policy change. So having more Kazakhstani and Central Asian students here, more migrants here, having more British citizens going to Central Asia for education or for trips, that's something which I would say it's how you assess this in the longer run, beyond, of course, the economy and the other issues. So it's an encouraging start, I would call it, Bruce.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Luca. And we have reached the end of our show, but we will certainly be continuing to follow UK Central Asian relations, and we hope they're going to continue to get closer and stronger in the future. But for now, I'd like to thank Luca, Ajahn, and Ben for being on the program and sharing your knowledge with us. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfrl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.